prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Stay with us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of Reginald Perkins in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Kelly Epstein, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Dr. Linda White, mother of a murder victim, an expert in restorative justice.
Don't you know?
The Execution Watch begins.
Are innocent. Some get good lawyers. Most don't. State of Texas, killing machine.
Don't you know they're killing people?
And I am Ray Hill, and this is Execution Watch, brought to you on radio station KPFT HD 2 channel. It is also available on the internet off of executionwatch.org. Links to that site can be found on theprisonshow.org and kpft.org. Glad to have you with us this evening on this unfortunate occasion. Apparently, they are preparations are being made for the execution of Reginald Perkins, who is 53 years old, by lethal injection. He was convicted in 2000 of the strangling death of his 64-year-old stepmother in Tarrant County, Fort Worth, Texas. We have on the air Kelly Epstein. Kelly, are you with us?
Yes, Ray, I am.
Kelly is a reporter, and
I can't hear you very well.
I can't hear you very well either. Let me see if I can't increase the volume on your. Where's her gain? Okay, Kelly, tell us what's going on where you are.
Well, it's very quiet. It looks like it's going to be very quick. The witnesses went in about 3 minutes to 6. He had, of course, the media, and then 5 witnesses, and of course, so the execution is on. There's no outstanding appeals. And the pattern is usually in about 25 minutes, the witnesses will come out and they'll be over.
Okay, so the witnesses have gone in. That means they crossed 12th Street.
They have gone in. Yeah. They're going in, it seems now, just a few minutes before 6. I think they just want to get this done as quickly as possible, and they're bringing the witnesses in a little early.
They're starting early tonight in Huntsville. The witnesses
were going in a few minutes after 6, and now they've moved it up probably 5 or 10 minutes from the usual time. They started going in maybe 3 to 5 minutes before 6.
Kelly, are you there alone?
No. Dennis was here earlier, but, of course, he went to teach his class. There's 5 of us out here, a small crowd or small group, but no. There are 5 of us keeping vigil.
Okay, Kelly, we are going to discuss the case and put you on standby. If anything happens, you can reach Elizabeth on her cell phone.
That's fine, Ray.
Okay, and we'll put you back up when you have something to report.
That's fine. Bye now.
Thank you, Kelly. That's Kelly Epstein. She is a Huntsville reporter, and she is there at the Death House Vigil for us tonight. Jim, apparently, Reginald Perkins was another one of those cases where they didn't have to cut down a lot of trees.
They didn't spend a lot of time on this particular case. The Court of Criminal Appeals certainly did. Now, they did a pretty extensive hearing after the case came out involving mental retardation. They had a long, extensive hearing in a district court after the conviction was over with. But that was after the fact. Other than that, they didn't
buy it.
No. Didn't buy it at all.
Well, what can you tell us about this case?
Well, first off, when I read it, I kept thinking years ago, I remember reading a book by John Steinbeck, and he theorized that some people, in fact, the book was called East of Eden,
mm-hmm.
and he told about people that are born physically with certain things missing, and but the same token, there probably are people born and part of their brains don't work right. And I got the impression from reading this case, this is one of these cases where this guy, for whatever reason, birth defect or whatever, just there's something wrong because he did well in a structured environment. For example, he was raided in Arkansas, ended up in Ohio, went to the penitentiary on a life sentence for raping 2 12-year-old girls and sexually assaulting them. He was also linked to the death of one of the girls' mother. They think he also killed two women in addition to raping the two girls. One of the 12-year-old victims, he told me, she told he'd killed his mother. Well, she came home shortly after he raped her, and they found her strangled to death. And they also think he strangled to death the girlfriend of his wife's sister's girlfriend, another acquaintance. But they never charged him with those particular crimes. So he spent, got a life sentence in Ohio, and while he was in prison, his father remarried a lady when they moved to Fort Worth. And during the time he's in prison, his stepmother, the 64-year-old lady he ended up killing, was apparently very gracious with him, wrote him all the time, more or less adopted him, and seemed to care for him a great deal. And apparently, from looking at this, what I've been able to read about it, was pretty influential in getting him paroled out. He paroles out and moves in with them in Fort Worth, the Fort Worth area. He's there approximately 10 months, and she disappears. And it turns out that he leads them to the body, and they apparently strangled her to death with a, they theorize, a telephone cord. Put her body in a car, stuck it in the parking lot, and stole, I think they hocked her ring, sold her ring, sold it to a crank, then cashed some checks on their businesses, and basically did it for money. And then he ends up, not only that, he ends up telling his cellmate, kind of bragging to a cellmate about it, that all they had was a body and a telephone line. They couldn't get his fingerprint off a telephone line. Unfortunately, they got the cellmate's testimony. Mm-hmm. And the jury took him like 30 minutes to give him the death penalty. Because what happened when they tried him and convicted him, there wasn't much of a defense for it. When they convicted him, they got into evidence the prior rape cases of the young girls, the fact that he was a suspect in murder of other women. And I'm sure it just terrified the jury in Fort Worth, because you're talking about a man being linked to at least 2 to 4 murders of women, of strangling them to death, killing a woman who befriended him, plus raping 2 12-year-old girls. And it just, you know, it just scared the holy hell out of everyone. And the jury took him like 30 minutes to give him the death penalty. That's only he deliberated on it.
How admissible is the evidence of something said in a cell to another inmate who's, of course, got his butt in a crack, too?
The way it works, the state cannot put an inmate up to going to talk to somebody. That's prohibited, because what happens whenever you're charged with a crime, the moment you're charged, you've got a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And once that attaches, the magic word is getting the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attached. The state can't go behind that by planting somebody in the cell and encourage them to talk. But if you do it voluntarily, without any type of agency relationship between the inmate, for example, if you and I are cellmates.
Sure.
And I think I can make a case on you, and I go to the police, and I say, look, yeah, I think I can get Ray Hill to confess, and they encourage me to do it. I then become an agent for the state, and by me questioning you, it's the same thing as the state doing it, it violates right to counsel. So okay. That will not ever come in. But if you and I were cellmates, and you just gratuitously
just blurted things out,
just start telling me things, running your mouth, and at that point I get a hold of the state and I say, look, he's telling me all about this murder case. And what the state is supposed to do, and what they normally do, is say, well, look, don't encourage him, but whatever he tells you, make a note and let us know. At that point, everything you say to me is going to be admissible if the jury believes me. And that's what happened in this case.
Apparently. Well, I know the atmosphere in jails because I've actually lived there. And convicts sit around and talk about all kinds of things they ought not be talking about. I mean, I used to have alarms go off all the time because I would hear stuff that should not be discussed in any company, much less a bunch of convicts who need to play let's make a deal with the DA in their own cases.
While we're on the subject, one thing that we also need to mention is that this is true of virtually every jail and every prison. All the telephone calls are recorded.
Sure.
And here's what a lot of people think. They think because there are lawyers on the other end of the line talking, they're covered by the attorney-client privilege. That is not so. because everybody in jail should realize that any time they talk to anybody on the telephone, that that's going to be recorded. This doesn't mean they're going to listen in. What they normally do is make tape recordings of all these phone calls. And then what happens if a case goes to trial, then they may go back and play those tapes.
Well, sometimes they listen in. I ran across a situation recently. I was talking to an inmate in Harris County Jail, and she said, oh, I've got a friend here that wants you to call her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so her friend got on the telephone. It's not the person that called me. And when her friend got on the telephone and started giving me a telephone number, the line went dead. That is an indication to me because they're not supposed to use three-way calling. You're not supposed to carry messages to people other than the person you're talking to, and certainly not for other inmates. And so whenever they called me back and said, why did you hang up? I said, well, I didn't hang up. The line went dead because. And said, don't you understand? They listen to these things. So sometimes they listen to them in real time.
Right. But most of the general rule, they tape recorded, and the fact that a lawyer's on the other end of the line does not make the conversation privileged. And like I said, we've tried to tell people this time and time and time again that whatever you say on the telephone, just keep in the back of your head, you may someday have to listen to it again. And like I say, the only way you can keep any of that stuff out is if the cellmate is encouraged by the state or by the police to pump a guy to get information.
Mm-hmm.
If he just sits there like a vacuum and listens, all that's
going to come in. And how would a defense lawyer know that?
Generally, it's going to be in offense reports. When offense reports, usually they'll document that, and they'll have a documentation of when the informant talks to the police.
Okay.
And the problem is that a lot of times they're going to lie about it. That's one of the, and that's, you can't help that. And this, and, you know, it's a hard thing to have to explain to people, and this is difficult. One of the difficult things, especially in handling programs like tonight, it's not so much, you don't deal with actually what happened, you deal with what witnesses say that happened is what you've got to deal with. And as you well know, when people see things, it's kind of like seven blind men looking at an elephant, depending on their perspective. They can say different things, and all of them be telling opposite stories, and all of them be telling the truth on their perspective. And you've got to deal with what people say happened. And oftentimes that's not what really occurred. And like I say, they may lie about it, but as a general rule, there's enough tape recordings and enough paper trails you can track somebody down if they've been paid to be an informant or snitch.
You began this discussion talking about Steinbeck's East of Eden, elements of that comprehensive novel showed up in a movie starring James Dean.
Right.
And it's a mind trip, and I would encourage listeners to go to wherever they sell, rent, lease classic films and get East of Eden with James Dean, very fine young actor doing a very fine role and very complex personality, the concept of which came from John Steinbeck. But Jim, apparently this guy did rather well in custody.
That's what's interesting about this, because you'll oftentimes find instances where somebody's been a problem, you know, and they're angry toward everybody, and they're angry toward law enforcement. This guy apparently did real well in a regimented society. In fact, it was a whole pitch to try to keep him getting the death penalty, because when the lawyer's defending it, what he did, he tried to show and was able to prove that long he was locked up in a structured environment, he wasn't of danger to anybody, because apparently he never got in trouble in prison. Even had wardens and different people coming down and testifying that he was doing
on his behalf.
Yeah. Just don't be around women. Apparently the deal was he would kill women.
Well, the typical prison guard in Texas prison now is a woman of color.
Well,
so maybe things have changed since he began his... But he hadn't been there very long.
No.
I mean, this is pretty rapid turnaround. So he was not a spring chicken when all of this started.
No. And what's funny, interesting about it, and this is, I don't know how much you've been involved in this before, but it's interesting about men who end up strangling women, because the woman he killed, he strangled apparently with the telephone cord.
Mm-hmm.
And those that he were accused of killing, they all involved strangling women. And let me give you an example. Years ago, and this is kind of spooky, there was a kid down in San Leon that was a real nice-looking young kid, and he was attracted to older women. And this is how bizarre this stuff was. He would go to dances and stuff around that Bay Cliff San Leon area and pick up some older gal. And when he'd have sex with them, if it was a full moon, he'd strangle them.
Only during a full moon.
Only during full moons. Had to be old ladies. It's strange. And he would strangle them. And because strangling people is an entirely different animal. I mean, strangling
somebody,
shooting somebody, because he's strangling, you got to have real close proximity to somebody. Mm-hmm. And this is like almost face-to-face encounter. When you strangle somebody, they don't die like in movies. They don't roll over. It takes several minutes for someone to die from strangulation. And during that period of time, I mean, it's real grotesque because they turn blue and they have all sorts of noises. And I've talked to numerous people who've been involved in strangulations, and they've had nightmares about it. And when someone starts strangling women, especially older women like that, on that real intimate sort of... That close to each other, and they do a series of them. There's something wrong somewhere. I think it's one of those factory defects sort of things, or something wrong in the DNA, and that just doesn't make good sense.
But he had enough sense to work as a truck driver, handle complex mechanical things like 16 gear on a major overhaul truck, and was able to compute his salary.
Right. Because see what they do, and when they have the big flap over whether or not he's mentally retarded, the issue, there's three things you look at, what courts look at when there's a question of a guy being mentally retarded. One of them, you need to have an IQ of 60 or below, 70 or below. And so there's always a series of IQ tests going to be given. He was given three different IQ tests during this the legal process. He scored from 68 on one as high as 80 on another. And they thought the 80 was probably the true IQ because when he took the test that scored 68, it came after he had some sort of traumatic event that skewed the test. So he had probably an IQ somewhere around 80, somewhere in that neighborhood. And so what happens in order to have someone not executed being mentally retarded, number one, they've got to have an IQ of usually 70 or below. So he was about 10 points above that. The second factor they look at is whether or not they call it adaptive behavior. Although you may have a low IQ, can you function? And that's when they look at stuff like being able to drive a truck. Can you make a Whataburger? Can you do a Big Mac? Can you make change at a fast food store? They call that adaptive behavior. And then the third thing they look at, they say this low IQ or the mental retardation has got to happen before you're the age of 18, when you're a youngster up. And those are, and they give that test, and it's almost an impossible test to follow because very few of these kiddos ever had that many IQ tests when they're under the age of 18.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't account for the fact, what do you do if someone has a brain injury? Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's happened before. I mean, there's a famous case years ago of a guy working in a mine that had a spike going through his head, and his entire personality changed. Now, he's one time a mild-mannered person like you, and after he got hit in the head, he started cussing like me.
Oh, my heavens.
And just did the flip-flop on everybody. And thus far, they've given us this test, and very few people are better qualified as being mentally retarded, because to avoid the death penalty, you've got to be able to prove that, number one, that your IQ is below 70. Number two, you haven't got any adaptive skills, namely like you can't go to Whataburger and make change. And number three, you've got to have this problem before the age of 18. It's got the onset of the problem had to occur before you have age 18. If you can prove those three things, they can't execute you.
Mm.
But that's a real, real tough road to hoe.
Well, in the story that in your research, I found out that he apparently was looking for about $1,000, maybe to pay off debts or buy crack.
Probably crack.
Probably crack.
Sounds things.
And he actually probably made a little more than that, considering the checks
right.
that he forged and cashed.
Some checks, right?
And that kind of stuff. Could you look at this case from the record and give us some kind of idea of how well his lawyers performed? So he obviously had court-appointed lawyers. He couldn't afford lawyers.
Well, in the first place, the lawyers on the trial level, what they attempted to do, in fact, one of the arguments they made during the federal writs and state writs that his lawyer was ineffective. The truth is matter, his lawyer had a choice. He knew all this bad evidence was going to come in. And to try to dig up some things about the guy's background, he hired an investigator, and the investigator went to Ohio and interviewed every member of this man's family. interviewed the mother. By this time, the natural mother had dementia. She apparently had a bad drinking problem. Interviewed all the siblings and interviewed all of them, got a full statement from the man himself, from Perkins. And Perkins claimed that his mother was real strict, that she whipped him with switches and electrical cords, but mm-hmm. she did it because she loved him, not because she was mean to him.
Mm-hmm.
Although there was some evidence of her trying to abort him with a clothes hanger and some more kind of pretty bad things. And apparently there's a lot of fighting in the home between the natural mother and the natural father. And so what happened, they investigated, they sent an investigator all the way to Ohio, investigated his entire background, got all of his school records, got all of his records from the penitentiaries in Ohio.
And discovered there may be other victims.
Right. And that's when they started discovering there may be other victims. So what they did, they thought, well, we're not going to do a whole lot to ameliorate the fact that he's killed, we've been accused of killing all these women. The best thing for us to do, we only got two options, either the death penalty or life in prison. And if we can prove that he's not danger while in prison, let's try this option rather than trying to go mitigating a punishment. Because
now that's within the range of legitimate decisions a lawyer would make.
Because, see, here's what you got to realize, the lawyer, the position the lawyer was in. He's talking to a group of 12 people who've been already ahead of time, who've said and promised that under the right circumstances they could consider death as an option.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got 12 people that are more than willing to give the death sentence if they believe somebody's going to be a future danger. And that's the test.
That's
really the test. So here you've got a jury of 12 people already predisposed to give the death penalty, saying they could do it, and they listen to a man who they know has killed the woman who befriended him 10 months after he gets out of prison. They know that he's raped two 12-year-old girls.
Mm-hmm.
They know that he's a suspect in the murder of two other women, all by strangulation. And there's not any realistic way that there's no words in the world that a lawyer can use to
make all that go away.
To make that, because the issue with that might be a danger in the future. Well, obviously, what they're going to say is, yes, he's going to be a danger in the future. Well, the only other option the lawyer's got is try to get a life sentence. So that's exactly what they did. They prepare the entire punishment hearing under the theory that this guy does real well in a structured environment. And that's where they threw all their eggs, which is really the only alternative they had.
Well, how long did it take the jury to decide to toss that one?
30 minutes. It didn't take them very long. I mean, they just did it. In fact, it took them 30 minutes to, after they heard 30 minutes of deliberation, it didn't take them long to figure out.
They didn't have any trouble with the guilt and innocent pardon. They didn't have any trouble with the punishment pardon.
No.
What about his appellate attorney? They doing a pretty good job?
The appellate lawyer on the direct appeal, there was really absolutely nothing in the direct appeal to talk about, because at the point the direct appeal went up, the Supreme Court case on mental retardation had not come down yet. So that was never an issue. Mm-hmm. There never was an issue about putting in any mitigating evidence, what we call a Penry decision. That was never an issue. And really, it was a very plain vanilla appeal. They didn't even publish the opinion. They just promptly affirmed it. Now, what happened after the direct appeal was over with, the Supreme Court handed down the case in Atkins saying that you cannot execute retarded people.
Yeah.
Then what happened? They had a writ hearing, and that's when they really developed this record. Now, what happened at that writ hearing, the writ hearing is held in district court, and they had what they call State district court. Because what happened, he was convicted in the Tarrant County District Court. Direct appeal, he was affirmed by the Court of Criminal Appeals. And you filed a state writ, it goes back down to the trial court. And the trial court conducted an extensive evidentiary hearing. In fact, there were three different psychologists testifying about three different IQ tests. They had all the information that the defense lawyer had done so far as going to Ohio and sending his investigator up there, because the issue on the writ was, number one, were the lawyers ineffective? And so they went through all the stuff that they did in trial preparation, did a real thorough examination of the constitutionality of the state statute, and did an extremely thorough job at the writ hearing. Now, when they heard the writ hearing, the writ judge said that the relief shouldn't be recommended because they didn't think he was mentally retarded. And what happened, went up to the Court of Criminal Appeals, in two sentences they said, we've read the record, record's correct, and adios. That was it.
That was it.
So about a three-sentence opinion. And then the Fifth Circuit in the Northern District Court held a hearing, and they said that the state courts were right, that he got a full, complete hearing on his mental retardation issue, and they promptly affirmed what the courts have done.
And the Supreme Court would ultimately deny cert?
Denied cert. Because the real guts of this case came in the state writ hearing. They did give him a thorough hearing on the mental retardation on his lawyer being ineffective for not bringing in mitigating punishment. They thoroughly examined all of that. So his writ lawyers, and he got a fair hearing, I mean, as far as you can get under those set of facts.
Well, I mean, we've got a Tarrant County trend going on here. Yesterday's case and today's case both come out of Fort Worth, Tarrant County. And we spend a lot of time talking about how bad Harris County is. Well, Tarrant County, they're trying for second place or what?
Well, you know, Ray, the truth of the matter is, and I've said this over and over again, when I read those opinions, I can read the facts of the case and probably tell you what part of the state they came from, because there's something in the water around the Fort Worth area that makes people just tougher than nails. Let me give you an example. Typical Fort Worth case, gang fight. Get into a gang fight and they kill a guy. Then the guys that do the killing go to the funeral home and gouge the corpse's eyes out at the wake. Now, that's Fort Worth.
Pretty serious stuff.
They had another case out of Fort Worth where a guy's got in a fight in a bar and cut off a woman's ear and made the boyfriend swallow it. And then the same guy later on gave some guy an enema with a fire extinguisher. That's just Fort Worth. You know, that's those crazy people up there. They're just kind of tough. And this is, like I say, they're pretty tough folks. At that
well, point. Some of these cases, you say you don't think they'd be tried as a capital case. This case would be tried as a capital case?
Yes. The reason this would be tried as a capital case because they would consider him in the category of a serial killer. Because, what you look at in cases like that are the number of women he killed and the method he killed them. Like, strangulation is an entirely different way to kill somebody than shooting them in the head.
Because mm-hmm.
It's long and slow and it's very, very
requires some effort on the part of the doer.
You got to stand there and hold it. And people are jumping up and down when you're strangling them.
And you scratching and clawing.
Scratching and clawing you during that period of time. Plus they're turning purple, and it takes some time to strangle somebody to death. They just don't die within a minute or so. And that's real close proximity. You got to get something around somebody's neck and hold it, whether they're struggling to die. And you do that to a series of people, and there's something wrong with you.
But not enough to lessen your chances of getting executed.
I think today this would be a death penalty case today. Some of the cases we've looked at here recently would not file. This case would be a death penalty case because not only did he kill the woman that befriended him, got out of prison in a grotesque manner.
She actually corresponded with him, sending money.
Oh, yeah. She kind of like adopted him. And there's just something, you know, there's something wrong with this. From reading this, it just is not a natural sort of thing because it's not a guy that's violent all the time. We've had instances where people have done pretty horrible murders and crimes. But they've also been horrible in jail. You know, they've been horrible toward other people. Apparently, this guy does fine in a structured environment. And he spent most of his life locked up.
In prison.
Yeah.
Yeah, he would adapt well. And I've known people like that. I've known people that do very well in structured environments, and then they do not do well when they actually have decisions to make.
And I forgot to mention, too, he also beat on her, too. It wasn't just strangler, he also abused and beat her. Didn't sexually assault any of them, apparently. The only ones he sexually assaulted were the 12-year-old girls. But when he killed his stepmother, he beat on her, too. In fact, he told his cellmate he'd beat her to death.
Mm-hmm.
But the autopsy said
he was strangled.
Right, by probably a telephone cord.
You're listening to Execution Watch. We're discussing the case of Reginald Perkins. Reginald is in the death chamber. We're awaiting word from Huntsville as to whether or not the process is complete. That may be forthcoming here pretty soon. Later on in the show, I'm Ray Hill, and I'm talking to Jim Skelton. Jim Skelton's a practicing attorney with considerable capital experience, both sides of the bar, as a prosecutor and as a defense lawyer. And we're going to be talking a little later on in the show to Dr. Linda White. Linda is a friend of the prison shows, and she is the mother of a daughter who was raped and murdered, and she is a very active member in the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and she's a member of Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. We'll hear more about those organizations when we talk to Linda shortly. My name is Ray Hill. Jim Skelton is with me, and our producer has just left the room to go check and see if an incoming vibration of her cell phone is an indication that she should be calling Kelly Epstein, who has been keeping vigil on 12th Street in Huntsville in front of the Execution Chamber building. That's the Walls Unit. If you haven't been to Huntsville and haven't seen the Walls Unit, it is a very old and very imposing structure. It was Texas's attempt to build a prison that looked like the fortress prisons that you see back east, where some of which were built by the Quakers back in the 1820s, and others were duplicated by the various states up there. Execution Watch covers executions every time one happens. I understand that we will be back on the 27th, which is only a few days from now, because Larry Swearingen, who has a very popularly believed claim of innocence in his case, and we'll be discussing that case beginning at 6 o'clock Central Time on January the 27th, 2009. If there is a stay, this program will not exist for that occasion. You can hear it on KPFT HD2 channel if you have an HD radio that is convenient. Start at 90.1. HD1 will carry the broadcast signal. You can toggle over to HD2 easily on that equipment. And we will be carried over the internet on executionwatch.org. That's www.executionwatch.org. And so we have Elizabeth's going to connect us. Kelly, are you back with us?
Yes, I am, Ray. Reggie Perkins has been executed. The witnesses came out about 5 minutes ago.
Well, this is getting to be pretty consistent. About the same thing happened last time. They were early going in, but they were a little late coming out.
They were a little late, and you can't help but be a little hopeful when that happens. But he may have had a long statement to make, or there may have been some trouble with the procedure. We don't know, but they came out about 25 after 6.
Kelly, where do you work?
I'm a volunteer in church social outreach, Ray, in Tomball.
Okay, and you do reporter work for those folks?
No, I do financial assistance, actually.
Okay. Well, listen, how often do you make the demonstrations at the Walls?
If I'm in town and not traveling, I really try. A friend and I come up every time.
Okay, well, bless your heart. Give our regards to the other folks there. Comfort those that need it. You know, I'm an activist, so I've learned a long time ago, when the telephone rings, help those you can, comfort those you can't.
Hey, that's right, Ray, and I sure will pass that on and appreciate your show.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your support of tonight's program. That's Kelly Epstein reporting from outside the Death House in Huntsville, and it's time to get Dave Atwood on the phone. Dave is out at Shepherd and Westheimer at St. Anne's Catholic Church. David comes to us by virtue of connections with Catholic Church organizations here in Houston, and has been an activist opposed to the death penalty for some time. He is with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Their website is www.tcabp.org, and Dave is vigilant, and he is at the vigil tonight being vigilant, and is a regular friend and guest on the Prison Show. Has a new book out, Detour to Justice, and you can might look that up on the internet. You can find it. Dave Atwood, now author, activist Dave Atwood, has done that. You're listening to Execution Watch broadcast live on KPFT HD2 channel, and I think we have Dave coming up right now. Let's see. Dave, are you there?
I'm here, Ray.
And you are where?
Again, at the corner of Shepherd and Westheimer.
Any peak folks with you?
Any who?
Any folks with you?
Yeah, well, we had about six tonight, which is not bad. It's not nearly, you know, what you would like, but, you know, if we have six people, we can get pretty good coverage of that corner. And
well, Kelly said that they would have had the same number you had, except that Dennis Longmire had to go teach his class.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think that, you know, if we're there, if we get there at 5:30, and we're there, you know, to about 6:30, roughly about an hour, and, you know, we have hundreds and hundreds of cars.
Sure.
By that corner. It's a very busy corner.
Yeah, Westheimer and Shepherd is a very busy intersection.
Yeah.
It's the transition between what is known as Montrose, the community, and the Galleria.
Right.
So there's a good back and forth traffic there. It is unfortunate that I have to report that the process has been completed. Kelly reports that the witnesses have left the chamber. They got an early start. They all went in a little bit ahead of 6 o'clock, and they came out about 6:30.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I tell you, you know, Ray, I don't know how the people that are involved in that process keep doing it at this rate, you know, and retain any sanity whatsoever. I don't. Maybe they get numb.
But you know, I think there's only one steady, and that is the warden of the walls unit, who's it's in his job description.
Yeah.
But I think the rest of the crew kind of rotates.
Yeah, probably so.
For their own psychological health, really.
Yeah. Well, that fellow who's the warden now, Thomas O'Reilly, I've had two run-ins with him. Not run-ins, I mean, nothing. One time when I crossed the line up there and was arrested, and he came out and said hello to me as I was standing there with handcuffs on.
Yeah.
And then a second time I went up early in the afternoon to have a vigil on a day of execution, and I was sitting there with a sign and reading something, and he came out and shook my hand and said, "I admire what you're doing, and although we're on different positions, I'm having to do this, and you're out here protesting." And I thought that was pretty interesting that he came out and did that.
Well, you know, you and I are a little easier at this than our mutual friend, Marta Glass. Marta would have a hard time being civil to anybody that is involved in this process.
Yeah. Well, I figure that it's not going to, wouldn't have done me any good. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, there's a guard right up there, you know, watching all this. I'm sure the word went around the prison pretty quickly that he'd come out and shook my hand.
Sure, anything the warden does, I mean, in that society, anything the warden does that is observed by anybody who picks up a paycheck there gets around pretty quickly.
Yeah, I figured so. He seems like, you know, well, I don't know. I don't know how to talk about it, really. It seems like it would really, you know, I know it's really worn on, you know, Jim Willett, who now is the
curator of the museum.
Prison Museum, I know it wore on him tremendously.
Oh, yeah, and he's got a book out that pretty much admits that. And
right.
By the way, I have already mentioned Detour to Execution. And I want to say that, you know, you and I may not actually be strange. It is the process that's strange, and we're just trying to find a way to fit in.
Yeah, right.
So, thank you very much. My regards to the folks at the vigil in Houston.
Okay.
And
you know, we've got some really great people. Burnham and Joan Carroll are the ones that bring our signs every time. They're both Quakers, and they're both in their 80s.
Yeah, well, yes.
The ones that come every time and are the most faithful down here.
And I have also seen them in immigration issues.
Right.
I occasionally make those picket lines, too.
Yep, they're very socially conscious people.
Dave, the next one up is Larry Swearingen, who has an innocence claim.
Right.
And that is scheduled for the 27th, and hopefully we will not see you again then. Hopefully there will be a stay.
Hopefully there will, right.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Ray, thank you.
Bye-bye. And now Elizabeth is going to go try to find Linda White, and we'll have Linda on. Anything that we didn't go over earlier?
I was just thinking, Ray, you know, and the way that I think, and someone gave me a book back, Dan Grunson gave me a book on the death penalty, and I was looking through it. And it was so, what it is, a photograph of everybody who was executed up until the book was published, and plus minute details about what they ate and last words. And it even as the detail is the type of salad dressing they ordered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what people do to cope with doing that is they have a ritual.
Yeah,
and they're so focused on the ritual, like in the movie Dead Man Walking, the rehearsal they went through, and the way they were more concerned about the procedure than the fact that they were taken human. And that's one way I think they cope with it, is by ritualizing what they're doing. And they're very careful about recording the last words, very careful about what the last meal is, and that whole ritual they go through is one way to avoid thinking about the fact that you're literally killing somebody, that for doing something, you're doing something that you're killing them for.
Yep. Okay. Now we have got Linda White on the phone, and Elizabeth is trying to wire us up. Linda, are you there?
I'm here, Ray. How are you?
Well, if it weren't such a sad occasion, it is a joy talking with you.
Yes, absolutely.
Tell us what you do, Linda.
Well, I'm actually a retired college professor. I still work in some areas of restorative justice. I take part in something called...
Victims Reconciliation?
Religious to Life. It's a victim-offender encounter program that you come into prison. Victims come into prison and spend time in small groups with offenders, getting to see each other as persons, and it helps the victims to see that human face of crime, and it helps the offenders to see that what they did was actually done to people. Real, honest people, not simply the state of Texas.
And you come to that work quite honestly from your own experience?
Yes, from my daughter's death 22 years ago. Another sad occasion, of course. My 26-year-old daughter, Kathy, was sexually assaulted and murdered 22 years ago, back in November. And... It so happened that it was two 15-year-old boys that did the crime, and they are still in the custody of the state of Texas.
And it didn't take you long to find your way to this work, did it?
Actually, not as long as someone might think. It actually took me from that time, which was 1986, late 86, about 3 years before I came to a firm opinion about the death penalty. That was my first part of the journey. I didn't really have an opinion up to that point, Ray, which was kind of funny, but I think that's true of a lot of people. We don't think about it very much, and often I believe when people ask me what I thought about it, I think it probably was the same opinion as the last person I had talked to, if I talked to somebody with a real good argument one way or another. And it bothered me those first few years after Kathy's death that even though the death penalty hadn't been an option because of the age
mm-hmm.
of the two boys that killed her, nevertheless, a lot of people said to me, it's a shame that they couldn't have gotten the death penalty. And there were times when I didn't think that was and wondered why I didn't, and there were other times when I would vacillate and think, well, maybe it is a shame, you know. So it bothered me for those 3 years, and at the end of that time, I had an opportunity to do some reading and study as part of a course I was taking at Sam Houston State University and make up my mind once and for all by actually getting some information and not just having that emotional response and a knee-jerk reaction to the fact of the death penalty.
But you actually got involved with some vigor. I mean, you really were doing this victim perpetrator reconciliation movement.
I have. That began a journey to look for nonviolent and non-harmful responses to crime, because I think the greatest strength of restorative justice is that it talks about answering violence in a way that is in itself not violent as well. And so therefore it seeks not to add harm to the harm that's already been done.
And what has that journey been like for you?
Well, it's been incredible, Ray. I have met people from all over the world. The most recent great joy about that has been that when my daughter, Amy, who happened to be Kathy's daughter originally, Kathy was her birth mother,
mm-hmm.
and my husband and I eventually adopted her and raised her, we together met with one of the boys that killed my daughter. And there was a documentary made of that particular meeting and the process of getting ready for it that led up to it. And that was shown on television back in 2001. And since that time, people have been using that documentary, which is what we had hoped would happen, to show people about what restorative justice is, what it can be, what its strengths are, and to help educate people about the process and how it works. And people all over the world have seen that video and are using it in their work. And that's the most gratifying thing I can think of. I mean, it's been the most gratifying thing that's ever happened to me in my life. I meet people when I go to conferences and so forth that know who I am already from the video, which is a very humbling experience, believe me, to have somebody come up and say, you know, what an incredible experience it is to meet you. Because, I experience that all the time myself when I meet somebody that I've read or read books. Or
actually, Linda, you and I get to go into the green room and meet some of the celebrities.
Yes, okay.
I mean, Sister Helen Prejean is a mutual friend of mine and yours. Dave Atwood himself.
Dave is one of my favorite people in the world.
I do not know anybody who works diligently on this issue that is not overwhelmingly more humble than their stature would indicate.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And
in fact, I think that is a defining characteristic of the people that I know who work in abolition. Dave, of course, is the perfect example of that.
Unassuming, diligent, committed to the core. Sister Helen Prejean, world famous, award-winning, is just as common as an old shoe, and I have never seen.
Yeah, Danny Glover's another person.
Danny Glover, yes, all of these people whose stature, by reputation, is really significant, including yours.
Yeah, well, you're very sweet.
And we get together, and it's kind of like, you know, let's take a little time off the picket line over here and see if we can find the bread line so we can eat.
Boy, isn't that the truth?
Are you faring well in semi-retirement?
I am enjoying myself very much because it gives me more time to do the activist work and to reach out to other people in this manner. I've been fortunate enough to be invited to come a few places that I actually could go, you know, because I wasn't teaching classes. And even though I miss many aspects of teaching, that has been gratifying. I think the last time I saw you, we had been invited to speak to a class at University of Houston at Clearwater.
Yeah, that's true.
Last spring.
And I still make every semester pilgrimages to Sam with Dr. Bruce in his class.
Yeah.
John Endo and I go up there to give a lecture, and it took him forever to take your name off the door. Because I'd always go by and check and say, maybe she's back.
Yeah, that's sweet. Jerry is one of the people I miss the most, Jerry Bruce. He is a
remarkable human being.
Gentle man in the highest sense of the word.
Absolutely. Listen, I know I have your permission to give your love to John.
Oh, absolutely.
And you know how important John is to me. And maybe this year.
Maybe this year.
Maybe this year, which is a phrase. Linda, is there anything you want to tell our audience that you have learned?
I have learned through much suffering and watching other people suffer so much that I don't believe the death penalty is victim-friendly at all, and I think that's one of the things that people use to pitch it to us as public policy, and I think it holds out false promise to victims' family members, and it's not restorative because it creates another grieving family when it's all over. And, you know, that is something that we seem to be able to just cast aside and not consider at all. Plus, one of the things that's really important to me as a victim is so much of the publicity surrounding the death penalty ends up being about the perpetrators of the crime and not about the victims of the crime, which seems to me a little backward. And then finally, we spend way too much money having the death penalty. The whole, you know, most people think it doesn't cost that much, that it would cost much more to keep people in prison for their whole lives, but that's not true. In order to have the machinery that leads to that door in the death chamber, you have to spend millions and millions of dollars to keep that going. And when I think about what we could do for victims in terms of direct services with that kind of money, you know, funeral expenses, counseling expenses for people and their kids, education costs, it really saddens me, and I think how sad for us that as a society we would rather do this thing that harms rather and tears down rather than builds up and uplifts people.
Do you ever you live in the Woodlands, right?
No, I live near Tomball.
Near Tomball, okay.
Not too far from the Woodlands.
Okay, I know where Tomball is. I've got a former companion over there with a wife and a baby, and I visit them often. Actually, in Magnolia, but you got to go through Tomball to get there.
Yes, I live between the two, Tomball and Magnolia.
but the point do you ever get to Huntsville and go over to the Peckerwood Hill and visit that place?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, of course, I used to see it all the time.
Yeah, pass it daily.
All the time. And it's one of the most striking sights, I think, that I've ever seen. Very sad.
It's enormously attractive to any documentary filmmaker.
Yeah.
I have ever carried to the neighborhood. Just can't get out of that cemetery. We're talking about the indigent inmate cemetery in Huntsville.
Uh-huh.
Convicts call it Peckerwood Hill. The name of it is actually Captain J. Byrd Cemetery.
He used to tell a wonderful story about Joe Byrd.
Yeah. Excuse
and
me.
Next time I see you, I'm going to get you to tell that story again to me.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell about it because I knew him whenever he would out in the turnaround out in the quadrangle at the balls. But Linda, I love you. I'm going to sum up your commentary by saying the love always lingers and the closure never comes.
I know.
Fair enough?
Me too, Ray. I look forward to the next time I see you.
Thank you, ma'am.
I can get a big hug.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Linda Green. Remarkable lady indeed. I mean Linda White, I'm sorry. Wrong color. Linda White, and she is an IR friend. She's friend of the prison show. Well, you're listening to Execution Watch. Linda White is called in by phone, and I am here with Jim.
Yes.
Jim, time's a-wasting. We've got four or five minutes here. Any commentary on any of this?
You know, I was really interested. Here not long ago, it's one of the things I never want to do again, a group of lawyers were invited to talk to some victims' rights groups.
Mm-hmm.
And these were primarily people whose children had been killed. And I had never seen so much hate and anger in my lifetime. I mean, it acted like we were the ones that actually did the killing. The hostility you could cut with a knife. And I realized that when someone dies, there's a hole left in your soul. But you'll never be the same after, especially when someone loved one has died. Sure. You can't be the same. But you can also take that hurt and it can ruin your life, wreck your life. You can spend the rest of your life hating. And it is amazing the difference in attitude of this woman had, because her life is never going to be the same.
Well, she wrestled with it, apparently. Yeah. She talked about it.
And she's a happy person. She's she laughs. She's a happy person. And I remember in the room with these people, and they were angry at everybody. I mean, there's nothing you could have said to have made those folks happy. You'd have pulled up the people that committed the crime and cut them up and barbecued them. That wouldn't have made them happy. It just simply wouldn't work. And, you know, you've got, and life is tough, and you've got to learn to deal with that. And I've often tried to talk to people about this and say this over and over again. I've mentioned on this show before, if you had to make your choice, would you prefer to be the parent of a child who was killed or the parent of the child who did the killing?
Well, since I have known both of those classes of parents, you can't drive a playing card between the differences in their experience. No mother wants to stand behind a glass and watch her son executed, no matter what he's done. No mother wants to bury a child. At one point in the prison show, I did an experiment. I had a series of interviews with crime victims, survivors of crime mm-hmm. victims. And I got them from parents of murdered children. And there was this one lady I will never forget. She came to the show, and this is radio, it's not a television show. And I had seen her at several meetings and all of that. And she had little clip-on butterflies in her hair, which was kind of fixed up like the hair a teenager might wear in high school in the 1980s.
In Tomball.
And some rural small right. high school. And my impression was that she was trying to live her late daughter's life. And hair was a symbol of that. And that struck me as overwhelming. The interview went very well. I mean, I'm not an ugly person, although I knew the perpetrator in that case, too. And she did not want to meet the perpetrator. She wanted to continue to hate him. There's no chance of reconciliation. The perpetrator was available for reconciliation. He did not have the death penalty. But she was not. And that happens a lot. You're listening to Execution Watch. I'm Ray Hill. Our show is brought to you every time Texas does an execution. With me tonight has been Jim Skelton, who has a lot of experience as a lawyer on both sides of the bar, and does a remarkable job of coming in here and explaining all of these complex issues to us. We were fortunate enough to have Kelly Epstein, who was at the vigil at the Walls in Huntsville, just outside the death chamber, to give us a report of what was going on. We also had Dave Atwood, who was at the vigil here in Houston. Every time you hear that there's going to be an execution, there is a vigil at the Walls in Huntsville on 12th Street, and you can't miss the Walls. It's kind of an imposing structure. And there is another one at least this month, at St. Anne's Catholic Church at the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd Street, near the south end of what we call Montrose. Of course, none of this would be possible if it were not for the hard work of our executive producer. Elizabeth Stein comes in and prepares all of this so we can present it to you in some cogent way, and we would not be able to be heard at all if it weren't for the electronic wizardry of Otis McClay. All of those folks are involved in the family of radio station KPFT, which is in fundraising. Now, you can go back to Channel 1 or the broadcast signal, or you can just go over to kpft.org or theprisonshow.org and get a live signal, and they will ask you to give them money. And we will be raising funds on the Prison Show tomorrow night, beginning at 9 o'clock. This is Ray Hill, saying thank you for listening. Good night.